Welcome to our Inner Lodge Symposium, provided for you by the joint efforts of Associates of the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia, as well as from New York and from Washington, D.C. Now, our theme for this morning and this afternoon is about moral decisions, a theosophical approach to everyday ethics. And you must realize that a philosophy as broad and as deep as theosophy must be vast in its application to ethics. However, our subject matter for today is really hopefully focused on the kinds of moral decisions we will have to make, most of us, in our everyday life. Now, there will be a time at the end of the meeting in the afternoon, if there are other issues you feel have not been touched and are very important to you, that you can bring them up for questions and answers, as well as to follow up on anything that you feel might have been left out or you'd like to ask about the day's discussion. So we will have presentations throughout the day. They will be, each presentation will be about 20 minutes with a 5 to 7 minute formal presentation by a student on the general principles of theosophy as it relates to the subject, and then we'll open it up for questions, answers, and discussion. And we invite you all to participate. Now, the subjects chosen as you look at your program are in the format of questions, because we are in search of truth and about these moral decisions and we have to make. And since it is ultimately each one of ours responsibility to act as best as it seems unto us, the final answer is the final authority to the answer to these questions is always left up to the individual. So we are not going to put forth a series of do's and don'ts, but we are going to try to look at the principles and possible effects of how we choose to act, think, or speak in certain ways. So our first series of talks this morning, the first four, will really look at the basis or the thought or the ideas behind which most of us make our ethical decisions. So our first presentation this morning is ask the question, why be good? And we'll now have that presented.
Thank you. Okay, let's see if we can do this in 5 minutes. Why be good? The other question is, why not be good? So my job here is to present three fundamental ideas that really are the basis for all of our decisions. And those three ideas have to do with what we call the absolute, or the idea of deity, the idea of law, or cyclic activity, periodicity, and that of spiritual unfolding, or what we routinely call evolution. So, the big question is, again, why be good? And we relate that to the first fundamental proposition. The absolute, or deity, is, without a doubt, the essential nature of our being. That's what we are, whether we realize it or not. That's where we act from. Madame Blavatsky speaks about the great breath, which is an expression of that, and is one with law. And that great breath is the very foundation of periodicity. The exhalation, the inhalation, is the paradigm par excellent of every cycle that we can conceive of in nature. It is a give, it is a take, it is a sensing, it is a volitional act, it is a birth, it is a death. Once we understand how motion, as abstract as it is, works, we then begin to understand how motion builds up the ideal form of the entire universe, which is the evolutionary foundation for the organizational vehicles, or bodies that the true essence of our nature uses to come to the full and total awakening of the divine monad's nature or our inherent perfectibility. So in short, what we're saying is that we are the three fundamental propositions. We are the absolute spirit. We are law. It is not something outside of us or separate from us. And by the nature of being that law, we oscillate through cycles, through time. We are out of time and space in our true natures, and we enter into time and space through the periodicity and the motions of that abstract motion, our great breath, and work through forms to come to an awakening of that simple fact. So, why be good? Because that motion is the essence of harmony, of balance, of justice, of symmetry. It is the one motion that brings all things into an equilibrium. And it is the one motion that is always trying to bring those things that have been taken out of balance back into balance. And it does that through the forms, all life forms, that are in use by what we might call the divine monad or the spiritual aspect of our nature. So, if in fact we can truly realize that this is what we are, the question, why be good, really is the only question that has its own answer, because that is our nature. We become different than good when we become ignorant of our nature, ignorant of the powers and the laws that are inherent within our own being, and ignorant of the notion that the form that we use is not the essence of our being, i.e., we misidentify what we are with who we think we are as being separate from everything else and everyone else. When we engage in that separateness and make decisions from that point of view without thinking about the whole, then we create disharmony. Because we typically, through mistaken identity, act from the point of view of a personality that then once has desires, clings, and causes disturbance. So, in a nutshell, to recognize what we are, to act accordingly, is to act in harmony with the law of our own being, and in doing so, we act according to the three highest principles of our being, what we call spirit, soul, and mind, and the motion of those principles awakens within the very substance that we use. If we think about the three qualities, light, passion, darkness, the highest quality of light, which then allows us to see in and understand all things, to act according to that understanding, and to raise up all of nature in one great effort to its highest expression in any particular period of evolutionary time or cycle. We no longer become afraid of death because we recognize the immortality of our being. And with that wisdom, with that enlightenment, we serve and we serve all of life.
Thank you. Yes?
If I really am that, as you said, that higher spiritual essence, why do I even want to not be good? Why do I want to be bad?
If we are that true essence, why do we want to be bad? It doesn't make any sense. There is no desire to be bad. It's only the difficulty that we run into when we forget that that is our nature. When we do not realize or feel that that is our nature. If we did, we would recognize that, as the teachings say, there is only one life, one law, one expression. And in doing so, when we serve all of life, we serve ourselves yet we serve in a very impersonal way. So again, if we recognize and realize that that is our nature, there is no desire to do other than that natural inherent good, which is the law of all of life and being. Your call, or am I
going?
No.
You started out with the breath, the inhale, exhalation, inhalation. If I use the analogy as above, so below, the pacemaker for the human breath in us is our heart. What would you say is that pacemaker in nature?
What is the pacemaker in nature? The one life? Period. That is the great breath, which becomes motion in time and space. If we think of, a sine wave, and that plane through which it cuts, that heart would be that nodal point in the center that generates both the upward and the downward curve. It is neither of those, but by its own inherent breath, by its own inherent motion, it generates all duality. And HPB tells us that in literal words in the SD. And that duality then mixes to create a trinity, which then is the base, whether we're talking about Parabrahm, Mula Prakriti, Purusha, Prakriti, Atma, Buddhi, doesn't matter, for the unfolding of everything else through which that true monad or heart works.
Back, please.
So if we are inherently good, then, I mean, we're all seeing those that are not good. So what is it then that is blocking that inherent quality of goodness to express itself?
What blocks the inherent quality of goodness to express itself? The failure of individuals to sense that there's only one life acting through all beings. Think of this. If you could recognize that there was one sun in the heart of each being, if we use that metaphor, when we saw that sun in each and every one, it would not be different. And if we saw that the sun within this form was the sun within that form, there would just be a mutual rising to work together. Because it would realize that, wow, one sun, if we put them together, it's great sun. The difficulty is, if we use again the metaphor, the rays of the sun as they emanate from that center take on characteristics which Madame Blavatsky tells us becomes the qualities. And the qualities have differences. And as the qualities then obscure or inform that sun, the sun becomes invisible. The individuals mistake the life that comes from that sun for the life of the form that they use, identify with the form, think of themselves as different, and as a result of that, feel that they have a need to do what they need to do to survive. Hence, survival of the fittest, which becomes a real misunderstanding of what life is supposed to be. And when we act from that perspective, it's, let me get what I can for myself because I've got to survive. All based on misunderstanding.
So how do we differentiate good from bad? So to steal is bad, but if you steal to save somebody's life, is that good or is that bad?
How do we differentiate good from bad? And that is going to be the moral question. Because, and this is a difficult pill to swallow, and the teachers tell us this, but we have to be very careful with how we understand it. In truth, there is neither good nor bad. And yet, when we create a context in which action occurs, we speak about relative truth of good and bad. And that relative truth becomes a standard that individuals use only because they think of themselves as different than others. So if we never see ourselves as that one sun, that one spiritual life, that one true life, then we have to enter into that arena. We have to be born into forms, and we have to struggle as self versus other, making what we call moral and immoral, legal and illegal decisions creating karma, further obscuring our true nature, and getting caught up in this ceaseless wheel of beneficial but problems in existence. So, in a sense, we have to go backwards and think backwards. The Buddha spoke about the 12 great causes of existence, beginning with ignorance, and that ignorance shapes consciousness. Consciousness works through mind. Mind sees itself as separate. Then it has to embrace and contact external objects, which we get sensation from. Then we judge whether we like it or we don't like it. Then we hate and we love, and we avoid and we move towards, and it gets crazy. So we have to kind of work backwards to understand that if we're all one, the question of moral and ethics does not come up, because we're going to treat each one as self. And that's an impersonal self, which is a great self.
Was there a question back here? Did you have a question?
Well, I think she kind of
okay. Asked. I think the John over here, did you have your... No? Okay.
Well, does this misunderstanding automatically disappear when we enter our mind body, so to speak, or...
Does this misunderstanding automatically disappear? First, let me say that, no. But when we enter, and I'll have to paraphrase that because I'm not quite sure how you mean it, when we enter our true self, yes. From the top down, we see one truth. Think of it as the point of the pyramid. From the bottom up, by necessity, we have to look at it as multiple relative truths. So if we are able to enter into the heart of our being, the essence, that life which is ours, which is one, which is the same in everything, whether we're talking particles, atoms, elements, organizational forms, kingdoms of nature, cosmos, it doesn't matter. If we can recognize and experience that one life, then we can appreciate. And the misidentification, yes, drops away, because that itself is an illusion. Yet, as Madame Blavatsky tells us, any illusion that consciousness experiences, which is on the same plane as itself, becomes a reality. That's the catch-22. But if we get there, we can see then that all we see is just one light. And let me take a moment just to really segue. There was a book that was written by a neurosurgeon called A Stroke of Luck. Did anyone hear of it? A Stroke of Luck. Yeah, I'm sorry, A Stroke of Insight, yes. And basically what happened was she stroked out her left hemisphere, which is the cognitive, orienting, temporal, time and space piece of brain that locks us into this illusion. And operated from her right hemisphere, which is more of a gestalt, a universal, and truly integrated. And one of the difficulties that she had, bless her heart, was when she operated from that right side, differentiating things, because things did not exist. What she described was almost a field of energy that was in motion, that had variable characteristics, and she determined the nature by how she perceived that energy flow and the tones, which brings us to sound and light, which are the essence of our being. Thanks. Although that wasn't the essence of what she saw.
Thank you. Perhaps you'll join us again later.
Oh, anytime.
Time. Okay.
Thank you.
If you have further questions, you will see that there's an interblending throughout the day. We're going to, at different times, focus on different issues, but since many of them are connected, your questions can be brought up within that context as well. So we think we would agree that for most human beings, we tend to want to avoid pain and move towards pleasure, whatever we define that pleasure to be, that good to be. So the question comes up, why can't I just live for pleasure? And we will now have this presentation.
Hi, friends. Why can't we live just for pleasure? Why can't we live just for pleasure? Well, a very good answer to that question is a passage from the Katha Upanishad, which says, "The joy of the spirit ever abides, but not what seems pleasant to the senses." Both these, prompting us to action, differ in their purposes. All is well for those who choose the joy of the spirit, but they miss the goal of life who prefer the pleasant. Perennial joy or passing pleasure, that is the choice one is to make always. So here we have a contrast between joy on the one hand and pleasure on the other. Joy is associated with spirit, which was what we just heard about, the self, ultimately the absolute reality, our higher nature. And pleasure is associated with the senses, that is part of our lower nature. So this points to an essential dual aspect of our nature. We have a higher nature and a lower nature, a spiritual nature and a material nature. What are they? The higher nature consists of basically three principles, which in Sanskrit are Atma, Buddhi, Manas. Atma is that same absolute reality as it abides in each and every being, every cell, everywhere, omnipresent, all one self. Buddhi is the highest aspect of soul, discrimination, storehouse of wisdom, which abides in each and every one of us. And the higher aspect of manas, mind, is the thinking principle in us. These three, Atma, Buddhi, and the higher aspect of manas, are immortal. They are our real self, the one we take with us from life to life, that stays with us during our rest between lives. Has no beginning or end, the immortal us. It, when this aspect of our nature identifies with the whole of life, the oneness of life, it seeks union with all of life and to foster that union in life. And when its behests are followed, the result is abiding joy. The other aspect of our nature, as a lower nature, consists of four principles. First, we have this physical body, but behind and within that, we have an astral body, the electromagnetic pattern for this physical body, which most people don't see or hear, but actually there are a few who can. There is the prana, the life energy that holds it all together during a lifetime. There is kama, the principle of desires and passions, and there is the lower aspect of mind. This is our mortal nature. It lasts only for a single life. We use it, discard it at the end of life. This part of our self identifies with that single personal self. We are this name, we live at this address, we have this occupation, this is who and what we are. It seeks personal self-aggrandizement, fosters itself. It wants possessions for itself. It wants to survive. And when the behests of this aspect of our nature are followed, the result is pleasure, passing pleasure at best. Why passing pleasure? Passing pleasure, as opposed to abiding joy, means that it doesn't last. It is the nature of pleasure to not last. It's temporary. And pleasure is attached to its opposite, pain, just as everything in the manifested world is dual, night and day, up and down, here and there, hot and cold, pleasure and pain. They're two aspects of the same thing, two sides of the same coin. You can't have one without the other. Pleasure always has pain associated with it. There is the pain that comes when you don't get what you want. You don't get the pleasure you want. The 6 o'clock news comes on, and it doesn't come on all of a sudden, and then you don't know what to do. Pain is associated with pleasure when you get too much pleasure, too much of a good thing. It actually hurts if you have too many banana splits. It hurts. Pain comes when you have the pleasure, but you fear its end. You know deep down it will end, and there's pain there. Pain and pleasure, part of this material, finite world. And this is opposed to the joy of the spirit, which is ever abiding. Here the terms used in the Upanishads are abiding, perennial, forever. This joy has no end. What is this joy? It is the joy of freedom from attachments, the joy of realization of that one self that abides in all and each and every one of us. It is the joy of enlightenment, the joy of illumination, compared with which any pleasure is a very, very pale shadow. So, which do we want? Abiding joy or passing pleasure? Thank you.
Your questions, comments, welcome. Thank you.
Well, you spoke that I should follow my lead from behest of the higher self rather than the lower aspects of my being. Just like the previous speaker spoke from acting from the higher pinnacle of the pyramid rather than the four corners. My question is, how do I get to that upper self so that my perspective is always from that higher point rather than from the lower? Because then I can see the proper relative good versus bad versus neither.
Okay. Great question. Practical question. We take ourselves from where we are, wherever we are. And where we are, for the most part, all of us, we're not there yet. So there is a course of training that we must undergo if we want to go from here to there. And that training involves our entire nature. And it involves our physical nature, our senses, our desires, our passions, our thoughts, our moral choices in life. Each and every one of that, those areas in our nature need to be examined and purified, strengthened, and concentrated in the self. This is a huge undertaking. You have to realize, too, that we have spent many, many, many lives conditioning ourselves to be the way we are now. It's taken us a long time to mess up so badly. And so here we are. But we have to eventually undergo this training. Very often the wise ones teach us to train the senses. That's the most obvious part of this composite nature that we are. Training the senses is a big part of it. In the Bhagavad Gita it says, a wise man, like a tortoise drawing in its limbs, the wise man controls his senses. A wise man controls his senses. He has power over his senses. His senses don't lead him. He leads the senses. The voice of the silence says, the wise ones tarry not in pleasure grounds of senses. The wise ones heed not the sweet-tongued voices of illusion. The wise ones, the ones who have done that, have trained their senses. So we can too. We can do that. We can do that in obvious areas like food. Food choices. Big, big, big problem. And we can decide whether we want to eat this piece of food or this piece of food. It's a moral choice. In a sense, it's a moral choice because where that food comes from. and the nature of that food and how healthy it is, and if we do eat healthy, why do we eat healthy? Is it for ourselves alone, or is it we have better instruments to serve life? All these kinds of questions come in with food choices. Another area is entertainment. It's a huge part of our lives. Movies, TV, books, radio, internet, all of it. We're exposed to huge amounts of information and entertainment, and we have a moral choice as to what we're going to listen to and what we're not going to listen to, what we're going to see and not, what we're going to read and what we're not going to read. We can make choices for the one hand towards perennial joy or towards passing pleasure in each and one of these areas.
Yes, Boucher.
In regards to the training, you spoke of that desire fulfilled essentially leads to pleasure, and desire unfulfilled eventually leads to pain. In this stage, in our not complete understanding of the eternal good, is it better to move forward from here, reattuning our desires to what we think is good, or reattuning our desire principle to not desire?
Okay, is it better to attune our desires to what is good, or to not desire at all? Desire is an essential part of our nature. One of our principles is kama, the principle of desire, and we have a higher desire that probably resides in the Buddhic nature, which is the desire for peace and harmony and love and compassion and oneness in the world. So we really cannot become entirely desired. We can become free from selfish desires, which is the goal. When we say free from desire, what we really mean is free from selfish desire, desire for our own personal well-being, often at the expense, ignoring the well-being of others, and sometimes being even at the expense of others. So, and if we look at it that way, I don't know if there's really a dichotomy between no desire and good. So, what we want to eventually eliminate all selfish desires, and that's not going to happen immediately. It's going to take a long time and with a lot of effort. So, training the senses is one area. Training the mind is a very, very important area. It's a more difficult task, but it's actually not totally unrelated to training the senses. When you train your senses, you are training your mind to a great extent. Training the mind involves, for instance, being one-pointed. Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, when thine eye is single, thy body shall be full of light. So when we go through life, through the day, concentrated on one thing at a time, we are training our mind to have that laser-like concentration which we need in order to perceive the self in all. We cannot perceive the self in all with an unconcentrated mind, only with a direct, laser-like, controlled thinking principle can we have that kind of insight. So this whole idea of multitasking and doing as many things as you possibly can is totally counterproductive to the true end in view from a spiritual point of view. That's, yeah.
Yes. Down here. Please. Down here, over.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
Now, we find that nature has provided us with senses. So it's through our senses that we can contact the illusionary world. So it seems to be when we identify it, as it makes sense, because this is what we have the senses for, to identify what we see, specific now in the springtime. You see the display of harmony in nature, the trees, the branches, the flowers. Even that plant there by the window, all the leaf faces the window. So it's so much harmony, cooperation. So the illusionary world seems to be that it's very important to us. Otherwise, we will not need the senses for it.
The illusionary world is important. Otherwise, we wouldn't need or have these senses. That's true. This is the point in evolution that we have reached. This is the reality that we need to deal with. We have, in a sense, created. This is what we need, but we have to progress from this. The senses are extremely important. We don't mean to denigrate the senses. Can you imagine what living would be like if we didn't have any? We would not be able to function on this plane at all. And we need to function on this plane because this is where we are at evolution. And this is where our regeneration must take place. This is where our salvation must take place. This is the tool. This is the scenario of our drama. The question is about identification, however. Because we have senses doesn't mean we need to identify with them and what we perceive through them. We are to identify with the immortal self that is within, the dweller within, and not with the passing show that it perceives. And it's that identification with the passing show that gets us caught up and in trouble.
Take pleasure in making that effort and that training and realize that it's contentment. It's not the pleasure that I've been used to.
Yeah. The word pleasure, we use it in a contrasted with joy, but it can be used as synonymous with joy if you mean it in that higher sense, in the sense of the pleasure in the good of all, pleasure in beauty, pleasure in harmony, pleasure in the goodness of others, and in the divine light that shines in all those pleasures, yeah, that's true joy.
In the back.
You pointed out that we can't really get rid of desire. It's part of our nature. And one, so it's how we direct our desire, whether, as you say, we direct it for selfish purposes, and one pleasure that can be achieved is by helping others, to strive to make other people happy, and there's a lot of pleasure in that.
Yes, thank you. That is very true. It's perhaps the highest pleasure or joy is in helping others. The fact of the matter is when we're in the realm of duality, of pleasure and pain, there's never really real joy. And it's only when we can go beyond our personal selves into that realm of the unity of all that we have true happiness, true joy, true pleasure. And when we learn to help others, we are whittling away at that identification with the personal self and strengthening that identification with the union of all. Every time we have an act, we do an act that's for the good of others, for the good of the whole, we're quelling the ego, quelling the personal self, the selfish self, and we're boosting and creating or revealing what is already there, our true inner joyful good, all good self that is always actually always there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Perhaps the first ethical or moral law we learned from our parents or from our teachers was that of the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Probably because it's expressed in one way or another in every religious tradition worthy of the name in the world. But the way in which we understand it and apply it is a different matter. And so our next presentation will consider, can we do better than the Golden Rule?
Hello, friends. Can we do better than the Golden Rule? Well, the Golden Rule is, it's a good baseline. But it's passive, really. It's not an active quality. Now, theosophy, which is divine wisdom, puts forth altruism as its goal. And more than just study, but it's unity, it's study, it's work. We need to study before we get, well, we think first we have to recognize the fact of universal brotherhood, which is unity. Then we need to examine the philosophy, test, check, and verify to see if it makes sense to us. If it doesn't make any sense, well, study more or just help your neighbor would be really the best thing to do. So there's many golden rules, as was mentioned, or many expressions of the golden rule in Buddhism and Zoroastrianism, the Jains. But basically, it's do unto others as you would like them to do unto you. Actually, it's usually stated the other way around. Don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you. So that's a good starting point. But actually, the Christian expression of do unto others as you would like them to do unto you puts the action first. So it is an active quality. But do we know how to really help? That's the key. And that is... That takes lifetimes, we think, to really know. But it is better to do something, even if we are making a mistake, because that's how we learn. That's the only way we learn is by our mistakes. So we should be active when it's wise. And we also have to know when not to help. We wanted to read, I thought this was interesting, I'm going to read two things quickly here. And one is Native American, the Shawnee tribe. We think this is an interesting expression, a very theosophical. Do not kill or injure your neighbor, for it is not him that you injure yourself. Be good to him, therefore add to his days of happiness as you add to your own. Do not wrong or hate your neighbor, for it is not him that you wrong yourself. But love him, for the Great Spirit loves him also as he loves you. And there is an expression, H.P. Blavatsky, this is her guide to altruism. He who does not practice altruism, he who is not prepared to share his last morsel with a weaker or poorer than himself, he who neglects to help his brother man, of whatever race, nation, or creed, whenever and wherever he meets suffering, and he who turns a deaf ear to the cry of human misery, he who hears an innocent person slandered, whether a brother theosophist or not, and does not undertake his defense as he would undertake his own, is no theosophist. So that's really a tall order, because it's so easy to fall in into the personality, the lower personal. This was said earlier, is just wants what it wants when it wants it. It wants to satisfy the passions and desires, and we need to desire for others that which we ourselves desire, but we also need to know what is best to do. And so sometimes we work on the mental plane. In our heart, we wish the best for others. We sometimes, especially in families and close friends, sometimes we have a break. And it's a break in communication. There's a misunderstanding. And we need to just step back and really wish the best for those, and realizing that this is a process. It's a long process over many lives, many incarnations. We all experience every experience that can possibly be experienced. There's nothing that we do not experience in the long period of evolution, which we've probably already experienced but haven't learned. But now with this knowledge, which is once again before the public since 1875, we have the tools.
Thank you. In the back.
It was interesting, the reading by the Native American. It almost sounded as though it was saying, well, do good for your neighbor so that you get good done for yourself. So when we actually are doing this, the active altruism, then shouldn't our motive be to help the other and not ourselves?
Well, we didn't get that out of that reading, but we should. We do need to have the right motive. But often we don't really know what our motives are. We're really not in touch with our motives.
Sometimes it seems like there's three of me inside.
Okay.
Because as I'm interacting and doing, there is this dialogue that's going on that's saying, don't do it that way. And the other one's saying, but I need this right now. So what is going on?
Well, when we want something right now, it's usually something selfish. It's most things we can wait for, including food. We can put that off. We're told that when we meditate, if we get up in the morning and our meditation is first thing in the morning, that if we feel hungry, we need to overcome that. We need to put that aside. That's an obstacle. So there are so many obstacles that separate us from others, and we need to, as was said earlier, we need to start to conquer the senses. Yes?
I wanted to go back to the question beforehand with just this saying, it's better to give than receive. So giving does make you feel better for a myriad of reasons. One, that you're in a point, that you're in a point in your life where you can help someone else out. And the fact that you're giving to someone who does need your help and benefits from your existence. So feeling good about this isn't wrong. It is a natural thing.
Right. We see many. There's many opportunities every day that we see to help that are very basic, and we do feel good when we help others because we hope it's not just so that we're seen as being good Jesus, what was it, the Pharisees that loved to be seen, you know, doing outward acts. And we think that to do a good turn in secret and not to be found out, not to take any credit whatsoever, is the best policy. And that strengthens the soul and it helps the other. And never mention it again, like, hey, I did this for you on October 25th of last year, so I'm expecting some return today. No, we don't want to go there. Yes.
So this morning I was looking on the Wikipedia about the Golden Rule, and there was a quote that I really liked. They said Hillel the Elder, I believe he was a Jewish scholar. And he said that the entire Torah, couldn't be summed up in the Golden Rule, and that the whole, and that's just an explanation of how we're supposed to use the Golden Rule. And you know, so I think the Golden Rule is a good starting point. But when I read people like Immanuel Kant, he wouldn't be like satisfied with the Golden Rule alone, because for him, do unto others as you have them do unto yourself. Some people like certain things done to them. And not everybody likes exactly the same things done to them. So, you know, it's a kind of gray area. I think for him, he used a categorical imperative. So you're supposed to act so that your actions can be a universal principle. So for instance, for Immanuel Kant, lying is wrong 100% of the time. You know, because if everybody lied, no one would trust anything anyone said, but we can always be truthful 100% of the time, because then everybody would trust everybody. You know, that's just, you know, some of the things that I have got.
Yes, the we believe the quote was that in the Talmud, that the Golden Rule is the whole of the Talmud, and all the rest is commentary.
Right.
So, but we need commentary.
You also mentioned it's important to know when not to help. So how do we know from our vantage point whether it's someone's karma to go through that event and for us to do nothing about it?
Well, how do we know when not to help? How do we know it's someone's karma to go through that event? Interestingly, more so in the East than the West, where these ideas have not been current for that long, really, there's a tendency to not act because that's their karma. That's, you know, it's, and in Islam, it's called kismet. It's fate, in a sense. But we're always, we think we only know when not to act when the other person really tells us that they don't want our help. If they vocalize that, then we need to back away. Otherwise, it's better to err in helping, we think.
I have a quick question in line with that. Very often when we understand the Golden Rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you or to us, it is from a very personal point of view. And we think that the Golden Rule then doesn't tell us what we need to do, what is the duty to our higher self. How can the theosophical perspective help us reach that higher understanding of duty or what we owe to our higher self, which may be independent of what the personality wants or desires?
How do we know what our duty is to our higher self? Well, the higher self, we think, wants there to be brotherhood, universal brotherhood. So anything that separates ourselves from others in thought, word, or deed is separative. The higher self, in a sense, the higher self is the observer, the best way to look at it. That permanent part of us, the man out of time, that spiritual soul, and mind. It's for whom the hour will never strike. The higher self can't be harmed, really, except through thy erring body. So that's a tough question. That's a really tough question.
Okay, in the back.
I always thought that it was incomplete to say, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It should be the following, because they are you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There is no difference. They are you on that plane, on that higher plane.
Right. That's what the Shawnees were saying, that your brother is you. There is no separation.
Did you have your hand up? No. Yes. Okay.
Can we help by not helping, and can we act by not acting?
Can we help by not helping, and can we act by not acting? Well, we think we can help by not helping. Because we can't, in a sense, like the masters, they don't actively interfere with anyone's karma. They can influence some of the minor currents, but they don't step in and do the work for us. If you don't do the work yourself, you're never going to gain the muscles. If you don't chew the food, you're not going to get the nourishment. So we can help by not helping. We can encourage, and we think we always should. And the writings of Theosophy, and perhaps as far as the day-to-day, Mr. Judge, his writings are, they're very inspiring. They're very reassuring. We realize that, you know, we can do it. If we can inspire that, that's the best thing a teacher can do, is to inspire that thirst for learning and growth. So we can help by not helping. Can we do without doing? Was that the other? Or what was the other part?
Can we act without acting?
Act without acting. Well, we're really always acting on one plane or another. There's in the Bhagavad Gita, we talk about action and inaction, and inaction and action. And that's something that we really need to examine and assimilate. There is, according to the Bhagavad Gita, we can act without acting. And we can also be active, but really not benefit anyone. We can harm. We can definitely do much more harm. And often, a lot of altruistic or so-called altruistic, well-meaning people and organizations are actually creating more harm than good. Yes?
This isn't my statement, but your thoughts are actually actions without actions. The energy of the thoughts that you release has long-lasting effects, even though no action has occurred. Now, again, I didn't say this, but my dilemma here is to get back to the statement that what is it that my higher ego wants from me? I believe my higher ego doesn't want anything from me. I'm the idiot. My higher ego is a genius. It would probably fear one thing greatly if I were to connect to it. That would mean the idiot walking into the temple of God, in effect. So there is nothing that my ego wants except to throw me into this, you know, river of fire and say, swim, you know, which is where we are, learning how to swim.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, many of us have a very strong sense of duty. And it's part of our moral decisions. We have a duty to our family, and we have a duty to our country, and We have duty to our community and to our employer, and it's a choice to do something for something more than oneself. But what happens when that duty comes in conflict with that strong inner voice of conscience? My duty is in conflict with my conscience. What do we do then? And that is the subject of our next presentation. Do I follow conscience or my duty?
Well, I must protest here, for it's my duty, because my conscience dictates it, that we don't follow anything. We become it. So we don't follow our conscience, and we don't follow duty. Duty is our past deeds, our past thoughts that come and greet us in this life. Now, this becomes our duty, our family, those that we have been born around, and we know that the family takes a great deal of duty to keep it harmonious. But duty being that, it comes to us. It's been created already. And it comes to us for us to fulfill in some way by reacting to it, not reacting to it, but asking us something. It is telling us something. And many people spend their whole life trying to find out what that duty is. And we do not have to look very far. We look around us, and our daily life and activities bring these things to our consciousness. Now, we all have a conscience. We know we have a conscience because we feel bad sometimes. I feel guilty. I shouldn't have. I did. Oh my. And we know that it's there because of the negative feelings. But have we stopped to consider that positive aspect of our conscience? It really is the accumulation of all of our experiences that have been integrated with the soul, so that it is part of our higher nature, our conscience. And the more that we turn to it, the more that we listen to it, the stronger it becomes. The perfect life is one's duty is dictated by his conscience, or our conscience. But as we see, we have choices all the time. So we find ourselves in dilemma after dilemma, not knowing what to do, not knowing how to do it. Well, in our everyday life, we find people around us that dissent. They speak out about something. They speak out, we call them whistleblowers. But something that they see as objectionable, that it is not moral to be done. And we are oftentimes faced with that. Now, many of us who were alive when they were still drafting young men into the army and sending them to war, this consciousness was very evident among a great many people, because most people, or all people, consider wars to be immoral. especially when they're motivated by economic greed and selfishness. But again, that is something each one of us needs to perceive for ourselves. Is that something that I want to do? Is that something I want to participate? Yes, I do have a duty to my country. But yes, I have a right to dissent and to question. Now, if we follow our conscience, we find ourselves loving more, because part of our higher nature is that bodhisattva nature, that Buddha nature, that oneness is a reality. Whether we consider it intellectually or we feel it in our heart. But oneness is the fact of nature. So our consciousness is tied into all of that. How we treat the earth, which we all, not one of these subjects is alone or singular. They all interblend, as was said. So, well, these are some of the questions, that we ask ourselves. Because we all are duty-bound. We all have a conscience. And we need to find out what our duty is and do it. Not think about it anymore, but do it. And if we understand that, then our conscience becomes clear. It is not nagging us or demanding that we be anything than what we are. So, go back to the beginning. We thought we were being tricked when we were given this part, but we knew the organizer of this had a very good sense of humor. So we do not follow our conscience. We do not follow our duty. We become that duty, and we become that conscience. And we appreciate one being questioned and see if we see clearly about what we are doing. So,
thank you.
You want to follow me?
No.
No, okay. And if we're back.
Didn't the Nuremberg trials underline our first duty as separated from what was secondary? The defense among the defendants was that they were only following orders in the atrocities that they committed, and therefore they wanted to be set free. I only followed what I was told to do. But the trials said you had a higher responsibility than just to follow what you were told to do. You have an inborn sense of what is right and wrong, and you're not to go against that. So the Nuremberg trials really flashed a light on that, and it was profound for
it was very profound, and a whole generation was part of that, who had defended this country and other countries against an evil, but many did not see that evil because they perhaps did not want to admit that mankind could do this to mankind. That was a very good point. And,
I was also thinking of the Nuremberg trials also. So that's interesting that you just mentioned that. But when I think about the Nuremberg trials, it was just the losing side that was on trial. And so those were the ones who were required to use that Nuremberg defense. But none of the people on the winning team were tried for any of the atrocities that they may have committed. So, if Japan or we would have seen a totally different trial. So it's just all about, I guess, how it's perceived. And I think when I read about Germany during that time, it was only like a handful of people who objected of even going into the army who were eligible. And the people who were conscientious objectors during the 30s, one man, I forgot his name, but he was actually executed for, just following his conscience. I think that's why a lot of people don't follow their conscience, because the consequences, you being executed or tortured to death, that's why people just do what they're told.
Well, that observation is quite correct, though. The winning side always makes the rules. But if we look around us, we see the same atrocities are happening all over the world, in many, many different countries. But in Africa especially, where starvation and other kinds of hardships face that whole continent. Now, the idea, for instance, of a moral wrong that has injured many people, well, we may not see it as that, but money has created the greatest of all evils. And we have a country that is built on capital, and that there's a certain aspect of this country or economy or world economy that deals just with money. And we saw in the last 10 years or so that there was no moral fiber in that institution. And the sad part was that they were never called to task for their deeds. And so it continues. Now, the evil that's being perpetrated is not so much of what they are doing, but how they're affecting the entire world. And it is only going to lead to more and more suffering that is not necessary. Because people, as said, do not listen to their conscience. Everything is here, now, and right away.
Germany was mentioned several times, we just think it's fair to consider the fact that the powers that be never went to trial for what they did to Germany after the First World War, where you had to take a bushel basket full of money to buy a loaf of bread. So there's responsibility there. We helped to create the situation that made all of that possible.
Yes, and it all goes back to money and power.
I'm sorry. In the back, yes.
Back to the conscientious objection.
We can't hear you.
Back to the conscientious objector, this when there was a draft.
Conscientious objector.
Citizens, we had to swear the oath of allegiance. We found out that there's one portion in the oath of allegiance which says I'm willing to carry arms on behalf of the United States. And we fought that because Hoover allowed that you do not have to include that portion in your oath if you are a conscientious objector. And the principle behind it is that if you are going to war, you have to kill because somebody tells you to. And we felt that we were not willing to do this. So the judge asked my husband or me, well, what if somebody attacked you? Would you kill? So, I mean, there's the thing about self-defense or hurting or killing under orders.
Yes, it's if we've never had to make that choice about being a conscientious objector, consider yourself lucky. Because it is a very difficult decision, because there's a lot of pressure to conform to society's wishes and desires. And there's and you can be ostracized. And that is a great controlling factor in our lives, because we want to be accepted. We want to be a part of something. And even though we may object to what's going on, we still love our country. We are just not very happy with its misguided application of democracy.
We think that we can focus on the Nuremberg trials, on the draft, but we don't want to miss the point that we all live in families, for most of us, and we all have jobs. And these same issues come up in that context, where you have to be or do a certain thing your employer tells you to do, but it goes right against the grain of your conscience, or your family wants you to do something. The whole first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is really about a conflict of conscience versus duty. And in a sense, Arjuna was willing to give up his duty as a soldier because in his conscience he didn't want to be the killer of his family and friends, and he didn't know what to do. So that's an allegory of our everyday lives. We can apply it to the big events, but don't lose sight of these principles in your own nature. Yes?
The other thing in the Bhagavad Gita that is often overlooked was that the family that he was fighting, that was ruling, were oppressing the people that they were ruling over. So he wasn't just fighting to win back the land or the power. He was fighting actually to relieve the injustice enforced on the people, the citizens of that particular land.
Okay. I know, yes.
So in the Voice of Silence, it says it is our duty, to defend any form of evil or to fight against forms of evil. So if you're going to war or if you're fighting to alleviate evil or to prevent evil or to stop any forms of evil, then is that morally acceptable to my higher ego?
Well, if something is evil, it only means there's the absence of good. So when in a last generation, there was no doubt in their minds of what their duty was and what their conscience dictated they do. But things have changed. We are more educated. The world is an open book. There's nothing that can be hidden for very long. And that our conscience dictates the fact that if there is evil, I must resist by not resisting. That when something is evil and we fight it, we give it strength and we're drawn into it. And the philosophy says, fear not. And that evil is nothing that we need to fight against. We do not need to give it energy and give it substance. It says in the voice that rest back on the wings of that great bird. That be so confirmed in who we are and the powers that we have is to trust in that. Trust in our karma, trust in that anything that comes to us belongs to us.
Thank you.
I'll take it.
Okay, you're welcome.
Thank you.
So we've, in our first four sessions then, we've looked on the mental plane, the different principles in our minds that we apply to moral decisions, ethical dilemmas of our everyday life. And so now we're going to move to the plane of physical action. And when we think of it, we're going to divide this into two areas. The physical actions based on our moral decisions that we make to acquire wealth, power, knowledge, all that. And then in our second presentation, now once we have acquired that, what are the moral factors involved and how to decide how to dispense it, how to use it? So our first presentation is it wrong to get as much money and power as I can?
Well, we have already talked about money. We've talked about nature's laws relative to this question. We talked about motive. Yes, that's important. That's critical. We don't always know what our motive is. We start out with this wonderful thing to help all. But then when we wind up, the push comes to shove, we've got the money and so forth, something else occurs. So, like other things, money or power is no more than a tool, a medium, if you will. It can be used for the benefit of all, or it seems to be far more common. We can fall in love with it and pursue it for selfish reasons. We find in 1 Timothy 6:10 of the Bible that the love of money is the root of all evil. The love of. Pursuit of money or whatever else to satisfy our insatiable greed is associated with desire. We talked about desire for a while. Let's see what HPB has to say about it. She said that desire, in its widest application, is the one creative force in the universe. But we humans never know desire under this form while we remain only humans. So our idea of desire on this level is very different. At the human level, desire is the motive power of the animal life. Desire is unstable and ever-changing and creates blindly and unconsciously. When pursuing money, we fantasize that it is the pleasurable thing to keep getting more and more. We just love to see our numbers go up. We somehow come to associate the acquirement of possessions with living the good life and are driven to keep pursuing it in a quest for happiness and freedom from worry. So, but we often know that the more we get, the more we worry. So HPB says something about that too in The Key to Theosophy, that the final goal cannot be reached in any way but through life experiences. And the bulk of these consist in pain and suffering. No pain, no gain. It is only through the latter that we can learn. Joys and pleasures teach us nothing. Moreover, she says, our constant failure to find any permanent satisfaction in life which would meet the wants of our higher nature shows us plainly that those wants can be met only on their own plane, to wit, the spiritual. Our material possessions are only transitory, as we indicated earlier. They bring real and lasting pleasure only when we take the position that we are stewards of those resources to see that they are used for the benefit of all, while ourselves being seen as nothing in the eyes of man. Some may believe that money is necessary to develop a generous character, or to be happy and free from worry, or for some other reason. But if we look at the great ones, we find time and again that they either were born with modest surroundings, or like Buddha and Apollonius of Tyana, left their wealth behind as they set out on the missions of their incarnations. As for happiness, HPB in the Key to Theosophy said that first of all, because our philosophy teaches us that the object of doing our duties to all men and to ourselves, the last, is not the attainment of personal happiness, but of the happiness of others. The fulfillment of right for the sake of right, not for what it may bring us. Happiness, or rather contentment, may indeed follow the performance of duty, but it is not and must not be the motive for it, she said. Greed is one of the seven deadly sins, in that it is a form of idolatry of self. There are reports that the wealth of the top 1% continues to grow, as the previous speaker was talking about, while the middle class shrinks despite the wake-up call we got in 2008 when many found themselves homeless, without jobs, and with diminished savings due to the greed of individuals in positions of trust. And there was a book that came out lately saying that some of them got in even better positions, so even better positions for them, bad for us. In the world of plenty, people continue to starve while others are morally bankrupt as they wallow in material riches. Theosophical passages on the dangers of greed often focus on the spiritual plane, the most dangerous area of impact. A few of the dozens of theosophical references on greed, I'll just mention two or three and we'll open the floor. Isis 1 on page 141, HPV, says, like attracts like, and greed for money, impure purposes, and selfish views cannot attract any other spirits than those that the Hebrew Kabbalists know as Klipoth, or in short, sorcerers or Darth Vaders, if we're into Star Wars. Dhammapada says, how can one who is full of desire and greed be an ascetic? The five messages, HPV says, woe to those who try to convert a noble philosophy into a den for disgusting immorality, greediness for selfish power, and money-making under the cloak of theosophy. Karma reaches them when least expected.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if our soul chooses to come into a physical incarnation, grow and develop would be more to live more of a humble life. Mm-hmm. If we, at a higher level, have an ability to choose which life we come into, is karma dictated, why would we even choose to come into a life that has the money if the goal is to come into a more humble life?
In this Buddhist understanding, if you got it, you know, then you have to make a decision. You know, is this getting in my way? Because of the temptations of keeping it or doing these things, or should I just, like the Buddha said, the Buddha did, just walk away from it? It takes a lot of character, if you will, to realize that it is getting in your way and to walk away from it, like he did, and like some others have been known to have done. So, this is.
There's a lot of people who do a lot of good in this world and who make millions doing it. Should they stop doing it? Or are they wrong for accepting the returns of their efforts?
Well, it said that for the high altruistic things, you don't take money for it. That's why the HBB talked about that. But you know, if you're out there doing good in the world, the short answer is it all depends. If you're out there doing good and it's part of the cycle and so forth, you know, you might even do more good. You know, I don't know. Depends on the circumstances. There was one in the back.
I don't think we really choose, like, well, this is the life I want to go into, or this is the life I don't want to go into. It's all these previous actions that we've done in previous lives that really make up the point. You know, the old idea, you can take a glass, but you can only put so much water in that glass until you drink it. So it's not like we're choosing, it's like the way we've acted in previous lives is what's bringing us back into a new life to go through the experiences. For some, many times. For others, maybe not.
Yeah, this student understands that we choose to come into whatever condition we're in, like you were talking about. We make those choices by our previous actions, by our previous decisions in prior lives and so forth. So our higher selves know that we need to learn some things. So we come into whatever condition we're in by that choice.
Yes.
Yeah, this concept of giving the money away just walking away from it, why not do what cancer does, give it to others? I mean, you know, give it to those who are in a greater need. Why walk away from it? Why did Buddha
walk away? Well, that in effect is walking away from it. You know, I see somebody
making good use of it.
Making good use of it. Okay. Yeah, well, maybe the Buddha gave it back to the kingdom. I don't know how the details relative to that.
Interesting. We're coming up to the birthday commemoration of Buddha. And at the time of his birth, the wise men said to the king, your son will either be the ruler of men or a great savior of men, but will, you know, have a lot of suffering, but he will be a teacher. And the king, of course, we understand the story, wanted his son to be a ruler of men and not a savior of the suffering, and so he surrounded him with all the good things in life as to keep him away from it, an obstacle. And so Buddha, as it said, as that conscience, as that intuition developed with him when he came in contact with suffering, realized that that was his mission, and in a sense moved away or gave up the illusion of wealth that was created around him so he could pursue his path of finding that wisdom that would help others. So he wasn't throwing it away in a sense.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes.
One of the interesting things too, I don't know about Apollonius, but Buddha hadn't spent, that was his father's wealth. He had never spent his life acquiring that wealth. Mm-hmm. That was his father's wealth that he would have inherited. So I'm not saying how much of a difference it makes, but he was never about trying to acquire wealth. He was born into it, and he rejected it as an inheritance.
Correct.
Yes, yeah. Over here.
So there's a flip side, too, of someone who was not born in a wealthy situation. How would you speak to that?
Well, yeah. I think most of us find ourselves, you know, on one side or the other that way. We have to start out in life. We think we've got to make some money. We probably, you know, in this society, it's kind of difficult to get by with nothing, although some people are able to do that and live a very happy life. The money is not what's going to get us the happiness, but we think it is because we don't have it. And we get it, and that's the cycle we get into. On our everyday lives and the challenge we're faced with, and that's.
I think with the more money people acquire or that one has, I think the more government you need, the more military and police you need to protect all that money, the more courts and everything like that. So I guess it's like a fine line, and you know, and everything that we've talked about is interconnected, because people like their pleasures and like their, you know, joys, and you need money or need some type of means of acquiring those pleasures and joys. Mm-hmm. But you know, the more you have, you definitely need more people to protect all that money, and you need, you know, everything that I just said, more government.
We are working to acquire it, or we're working to protect our basket. So it's right. You know, it's both of a challenge, and that's an everyday thing. And the again, for the higher good, that's it's tough. It gets tough, but that's the way we learn. Mm-hmm. You know, we all, that's our opportunity.
Yes.
If we ever, if we always knew and always kept in the forefront that we're all one, and yes, we'd learn to trust better, obviously.
So in the accumulation issue, right or wrong, it comes down to motive, of course, why we're acquiring the wealth. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that one of the principles is to fit myself to be the better able to help and teach others. So how can you do that if you're not making some attempt to acquire some kind of wealth? Maybe it's spiritual wealth or intellectual wealth or moral wealth. Making ourselves stronger so that we can be better able to help others.
Well, we that's our purpose in being here, is to help and teach, as you indicated. And, yeah, we have to be able to, you know, we're constantly working to develop our capabilities to do that. And this student has heard of wonderful stories about people who went out and earned money for a particular cause, to build a lodge or whatever the good cause might be, to really help some group to do something. We hear about the band of a half a dozen billionaires or something like that, and some of the really good things they're doing. Yes, it is our duty to go out and try to better ourselves in every way that is necessary or is needed to get ourselves into a position to give back, to be able to do whatever we see needs to be done. And sometimes that does involve in this world real world money. So it doesn't. So these are guidelines and not specifics in terms of what we do and do not do.
It's perhaps a different take on the whole idea of wealth, but if we're thinking about the Gita as well as Patanjali, the less we have, the more we have. And by that highest dispassion, which in a sense disconnects us from the qualities or from the influence of the qualities, and that nakedness that takes us back to ourselves, it allows us to see through all of the qualities, having nothing, yet being able to do everything because of that understanding. So without wealth that we typically think of, there is the wealth of knowledge that sees how things work, what each one needs based on where each one is, and how each one is obscured by those very qualities that we use to experience life. So it's a different spin.
Yeah, well, knowledge is the most powerful weapon you can have. Would you agree with that? Understanding a proper application of knowledge, of course, but you have to have the knowledge to apply it correctly. So,
thank you.
Okay.
So, regardless of how much power, knowledge, wealth
whatever we might define it, we have in this life, we come in contact with those that have less than ourselves. So our final presentation this morning asks the question, well, what are my obligations to the poor and the weak?
Just to go off topic for a moment, because most of you would not realize it, there hasn't been one duplication of quotes from the philosophy in this whole exercise this morning. There has been no communication between the speakers. None. It is. Wow, that's exactly how I feel. This question, how are I to figure out my obligations to the poor, is probably the most pertinent one of all our questions this morning, because it's right there, right in our face, whether it's having a homeless person put out their hand to us, or we're just watching the news, whether it's the local news, the national news, the international news. Everywhere we look, there is poverty. There is despair. There is suffering. And because we all are one, we feel it. We may not all react the same, but we definitely feel it. We don't even know the word. We think we might have to make up a word. A word of strife and struggle and pain. We feel pulled and ignorant all at the same time. And then we're left with a question, well, what can I do? I don't have that much money. I have plenty of time, but I don't know how to invest my time in helping the poor here or around the world. And if we look at the statistics, they are frightening. If you go back to the World Bank report in 2008, they said over 1 billion people were in absolute poverty. And no country is free from it. And at that same report, they said 1 in every 5 children in America lived in poverty. If you go online right now, you will find that 16 million children in America live in poverty. That means homeless, destitute, hungry. It's pathetic. We're the wealthiest community and we have this condition. Well, what are we to do and how are we to do it? Well, we're turning to the quotes from those with wisdom. William Q. Judge, in the closing remarks at the Parliament of Religion in 1893 in Chicago, said this. He, one of the adepts of the Great Brotherhood, said all the troubles of the world would disappear in a moment if men would only do 1/4 of what they could and what they ought. All the troubles of the world would disappear in a moment if men would only do 1/4 of what they could and what they ought. We think that's a direct message to all of us. Do we do what we could and what we should? In the Heart Doctrine, Mr. Judge wrote that the goal is to understand life, not to accumulate great occult powers, and that we have to reach that understanding about life and ourselves by practicing right ethics. And we quote from the Heart Doctrine, live with each other as brothers. For the misery and trouble of the world are of more importance than all the scientific progress that may be imagined. Try to practice universal brotherhood, which is the universal duty of all men. And then we turn to HPB. in the Key to Theosophy, duty is that which is due to humanity, to our fellow men, neighbors, family, and especially that which we owe to all those who are poorer and more helpless than we are ourselves. And here comes the difficult part. This is a debt which, if left unpaid during life, leaves us spiritually insolvent and moral bankrupts in our next incarnation. Theosophy is the quintessence of duty. Therefore, to sum up this huge subject, it is our duty to help where we can, when we can, and it is our motive in giving that help that matters more than how much we can do or how much we can give. HPB made the most wonderful statement that cheers all of us who don't have the wealth and power and wish we did, although we probably just think we would help the world. We probably would help ourselves first and the world later. But she said, we believe in giving to the money a thousandfold greater power and effectiveness by our personal contact and sympathy with those who need it. In other words, if you are in your own hand giving a quarter to a homeless person and your motive is to wish them well and health and a way out of their problem, you have given them a piece of spiritual life, love, joy. And it's worth more than millions of dollars. It's not the value of the cash. It's the value of our feeling that we project. Now, we have so many wonderful quotes on this subject of giving that we've left a handout at the front desk for you. It also contains a cartoon that sums up, we think, the true position if we could only see in this manner. This is on PowerPoint. Yes, definitely.
An unpowered PowerPoint.
There's a copy of the cartoon included in the handout. But if we could see that it is ourselves we are helping. Isn't that brilliant?
Leave it up there, Frontex. Your questions, comments? Yes.
What is the help without the money?
You know, when I think about it, it's like that's so relative, you know, to the situation, because even this idea of poverty, you know, is something that is created, you know, highly created in our society. You know, people aren't just poor because they're poor or rich because they're rich. You know, there are circumstances that...
But the question is so much more complicated, because we understand from studying theosophy that the conditions anyone faces in life come about because of the causes that they have set up. Now, that doesn't mean we see someone who's poor in a difficult situation and make the assumption that they have done all these incorrect or wrong things. First of all, it's just the tip of the iceberg, and all of the wisdom and learning that they have gained is temporarily out of touch for them. But the other part of it is many souls will take on such an experience just to have that wisdom What is it like to be poor? What is it like to struggle? So they become more empathetic. So it isn't the poverty itself. We do know it is created by greed. And we do know that we swing, the sine curve was mentioned. We do that. We have a life of extreme deprivation, and all we think about is money and health and security. In our next life, we may have that, and then we fear to lose it. So we travel that sine curve because we won't learn from it.
So with that understanding, right, what is the help?
The help that comes, truly, the real help, we have a wonderful quote from the Bhagavad Gita notes. The possessor of right knowledge will be filled with divine sympathy for all sufferers. He will relieve only such distresses as should be relieved in each and every case, while at the same time he will impart as much of his greater knowledge as the sufferer can receive and apply. So it's a question of giving bread and wisdom. The real help, though, comes from the motive of the giver. And that means even a penny given, it's the widow's mite, even a penny given with that right feeling and attitude is of benefit to the recipient.
One more thing is like, so I think it's important based off of what you said, it sounds, resonates with me, right? So I think it's also important to understand that you as the giver are also the receiver.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
If a person is poor and you're looking at them as the sufferer, that can be damaging to you because you never know, right? Those are reciprocal relationships. This is a sufferer. Why? Because they're poor, their clothes are raggedy or whatever. They don't have anything to eat. But that's an illusion, like you pointed
exactly.
to.
Exactly.
Right? So we have to understand when we come into those situations where it's acquired, it's appointed up to us to give or see something or make an interaction with someone, we have to understand that there's a reciprocal relationship going on.
Exactly.
There's no patronizing, right?
Two things. First of all, if we can't give money, and sometimes we can't, we can honestly see the person, look at them, smile at them, recognize them as ourselves. That's of benefit. But then there's this wonderful quote by Emerson. It is one of the most beautiful compensations in life that we can never help another without helping ourselves. It's just the way life is structured. So if in seeing someone in any kind of condition, to just realize it's a temporary moment for them, something that needs to be balanced just as we have that in ourselves. Perhaps the most horrible crime we're all guilty of is waste. We waste water, drinkable water, when people all over the world can't even get to it.
I think you got to my question, which is, we're talking one-on-one, which is this is understanding what is recommended, because the giver, as well as the receiver, is subject to getting a lot out of it. And the receiver, I mean, the giver could very well get more out of it than the receiver. But in this world, the way it's structured right now, where we have sometimes, we're in situations where we don't see the greatest need. And we have these institutions out there that, you know, that they're trying to get money and so forth and fulfill that need. That piece is out of it. You know, the giver piece, what's in it for the giver in that case? I mean, you give her $1,000 or something, that's it.
Many of us
course.
Had our hearts broken over that, what was it called? Something, the third cup of tea or something?
Three cups of tea.
Yes, many of us contributed to that because of the education of girls in Afghanistan. And but it does look like it's on the straight and narrow again. The problem with that sort of giving is we can't know that everything goes to the people who deserve it. But if we feel moved, we should definitely make the effort, even just to give a little if we can. In talking about the benefit to the giver, it is said when you feel grateful for receiving something, that that gratitude does more for you, the receiver, than for the one you're offering the gratitude to. So the, and that's another part of your question, if the transaction takes place properly, then the one who receives should feel a different kind of humanity, and that's to their benefit as well. We may be right now setting ourselves up for poverty by the way we don't handle the things that we have.
Yes, in back.
One of the quotes that you read about the books not being balanced and not giving up reminded me of the basic primer for this subject, which is all the way out of season, which is Dickens' A Christmas Carol. That gave more insight into the idea of charity, both receiving and giving, and the uplifting of the soul through it. So I'll go home, and even though it's May, I'll
There are so many opportunities, though, to give, and we don't even think about it. You can always give a kind word, a generous smile, a happy greeting. There's no reason that you cannot share the bounty of what you feel. And you may find many opportunities to share theosophical ideas.
Yes.
I often wonder if, especially like in supermarkets where they ask you for charity, if that money goes to line some CEO's pockets or whatnot. And if you look at the analysis of most of the charity groups, their CEOs are making millions. But that, some inner voice in me is telling me at the same time, you know, you shouldn't be concerned where that funds or where that money goes. What matters is the motive for what you're doing.
Exactly.
And the universe, even though I may feel it's flawed, or it may look it's flawed, those funds will go exactly where they're supposed to go, even if it's the pocket of some CEO.
No. Just because the universe is an expression of spirit acting through matter doesn't mean that spirit wins. They are opposite sides of the same coin. Sometimes matter wins, or greed, or selfishness. In the end, that will be a spiritual development, because those of us who can't handle it will have to drop out. So we'll stop messing it up for everybody else. The fact that something is collected and then misused and misapplied is not going to be fixed on its own. It's only going to be fixed by us. We have to learn how to motivate life around us to act in a moral way.
I can just do a follow-up. In this room, there was once a question asked. A person made a statement that the universe is perfect. And he was corrected by saying, no, the universe is not perfect. It's exactly as it should be.
No, we will object to that as well. As it should be at this point, HPV says we're very far behind. We're acting like juveniles. It should be now a more mature thought, intelligent soul in action. And we're not. We're behaving very, very juvenile. It's as it is because we set it up and made it that way. So you can say should be there, but not should be an intention. In intention, we're supposed to be much further ahead.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps we'll see that the real value of our meetings today is not the questions answered, but the thousands of questions that come up in our mind and decisions that we might make differently based on the little bit that we discuss. So the real vitality goes on afterwards. So we're going to take a break now for an hour and a half for lunch. On the back of your programs, there's a list of some restaurants in the immediate area. If you buy a lunch, you're welcome to eat it here upstairs or enjoy nature out in Rittenhouse Square. We'll be back at 2:30.